Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I am very happy to introduce my other co-host. First, he is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, as well as the co-host of the TV Break podcast, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Justin. In addition to those things, I could have been something. I could have been a contender.
Spot.
It's all you, man.
And now
it's all you.
Just a
you
bum.
Did this to me.
There I am, sitting really sweaty and uncomfortable in that car, in the back of that car. Oh man.
Am I the hired cab driver in this scenario?
Yeah, you're totally gonna rat us out.
Yeah. Speaking out of turn, but not unwelcomely, it's Noah France. How are you, Noah?
I'm fine.
And I should mention, you are the co-host, along with myself, of the Pod on the Rooftops podcast, where we discuss the rock band Genesis, something very different from this podcast, but still very fun. Very happy to be with you again. And this is actually part of our series of talking to people that we know and respect and their opinions about films. And as such, we have brought on a guest to talk about their favorite film. And on this episode, I am very happy, as someone who has talked on this podcast about the film club that I'm a part of, I'm very happy to actually have someone from the film club on the podcast, finally. Please welcome Pat Pinnell. Hello, Pat.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're great. Doing Thanks well. For coming on.
So yeah. I right away want to claim Eva Marie Saint. if you guys are going to be the three guys in the cab, I will very happily be Eva Marie Saint. In my dream, right. I will be Eva Marie.
Well, we'll get into that. I haven't even introduced the movie that Pat has chosen, which is On the Waterfront, if it hasn't been abundantly clear by now. This is the film from 1954, directed by Elia Kazan, and written by Bud Schulberg after a bunch of other, a prominent writer had worked on this at a certain point. But this was acclaimed at the time for both the movie itself, which won Best Picture. I actually had seen this once before because I reviewed every single Best Picture on my website a long time ago, and stars Marlon Brando in probably one of the iconic performances of film history, I would say. Like, it's definitely talked about in that way as one of the best performances that's been given. And it has quite a legacy behind it. It has a somewhat, let's say, controversial history. There's a lot behind the movie as well.
There's
which,
tea.
Yeah, which maybe we'll get into. But before we do, I kind of want to start with you, Pat, and just talk about your experience with this film. Like, when did you first see it? And what has your history been with it over the years?
Okay, well, the first thing I'm going to say is I'm so happy that you asked me to jump in, because in going back to watch the film and then reading a little bit about it, I became very ashamed at how little I knew about some of the background of the film. And it's been an educational experience for me in the last 24 hours to go and read some of the outside writing about the film and about how influential the film was. I didn't realize in how many categories this movie really has made a real impression on the history of film. But I'm now congratulating myself on my very good taste, which surprises me. But I think I was, I think I first saw this film when I was probably way too young for it, because I used to watch the 4:30 after school movie every day from Monday to Friday, once I got home from after school activities. And I think I probably watched this film multiple times then. I'm not exactly sure what in particular about this film really impressed me, but I think it was probably the first time that a movie really, really struck me as being incredibly powerful in kind of a social justice way. And I think as I was probably in middle school, I'm guessing, when I saw it for the first time. And I think that's probably a really idealistic time in a lot of our lives. And I think just this storyline of this kind of David and Goliath, you know, situation where Marlon Brando is really up against this huge corrupt, you know, organization and decides to take it on in the end, really, really struck a chord with me. I mean, in a personal side note, I think in middle school, my in quotes boyfriend was a boy who not only looked a little like Marlon Brando, but who had a real motorcycle thing, even in seventh grade. And
wow,
I used to sneak out, and he had a mini bike, which was all he was able to drive. And I used to sneak out and meet him so that we could ride around a park on his mini bike. So maybe I had a little Eva Marie Saint thing going back then. I was a Catholic school girl, so it all makes sense now. But that's, like I said, that's really completely outside of the boundaries of the movie discussion. But yeah, I think it really showed me what film could do, and how film could really take on and tackle big issues out there in the world and say something really important and go beyond just being entertaining. So, and I think over the years, you were saying, what has been the impact for the years? And I have to confess, I haven't watched this movie a lot over the years. I think I watched it with one of my children at some point and was really gratified when, I have two daughters and I watched it with the older one. And I think she turned to me and said, why have you never had me watch this movie before? And I thought, oh, okay, she's good. She's headed in the right direction. She recognizes this movie is good. But for me, I think the movie has just probably made me always very interested in movies that have something bigger to say. And I love a lot of documentaries for that reason. And I really like scripted films that are about social justice issues. So yeah, I think maybe that's one of the truly lasting gifts that this movie has given me.
Wow. That's something that's very prominent in the film for sure. So this was something I had seen before, as I mentioned. But so I kind of wanted to start with Alex and Noah, with you guys. And Alex, I know you had seen this once before, right? But maybe not under ideal circumstances.
Yes, I had to see this for a class in college, actually a theology class, as a matter of fact. And that really had an interesting effect on the way I saw the film the first time around. Because for the class, we had to really look at it in terms of the role that faith and religion factored into the course of events. And our professor was trying to kind of pitch it as this sort of conversion narrative, which is very interesting. And I feel like not necessarily what most people would talk about when they talk about the film, but it does add an interesting lens to it. Watching it this time around, I have been knee deep in The Sopranos for the last month. I've been kind of rewatching the entire series as I've been getting ready to watch The Many Saints of Newark. And
Drowning in Jersey.
And this movie slots very well into that milieu, but in a very it contrasts with it in a very key way, in that there's actual optimism, almost like a saccharine degree of optimism to this movie, whereas The Sopranos is all about how the people involved, the principals here, are all kind of despicable and cannot move past their more base nature, no matter how much they like to think of themselves as evolved people. And so that has created this whole other context for me to watch the movie. But that is kind of all secondary to the fact that this movie is a great film. And I think that the fact that it could be kind of read through all of these different lenses is indicative of that. I think that the performances are obviously very, very strong. Way more intelligent people than me have spoken about Marlon Brando's performance here. Yves Saint Laurent actually has like this really great little short interview on the Criterion special edition of On the Waterfront, where she talks about what it was like to act with Marlon Brando in this film, and it's very interesting. I would recommend anybody seek that out
if
you can.
Is that Eve Marie Saint that you're talking about?
Yeah. What did I say?
You said Yves Saint Laurent.
Oh, that's a different person.
I'm gonna say that fashion angle.
Yeah, she was just so high status fashion-wise that I just got them confused. It's easy to do. But yeah, so she talks about what it was like to act with him on this film set, and she says that it's like the one of the most interesting aspects of his performance was that every time that he delivered a line, it felt different. It felt like he was saying it for the first time, and it kind of really forced everyone to be more in the moment. And I think that really comes across. He feels like a genuine person, even if his delivery is sometimes a little bit more theatrical than what we may be used to in a modern context. It does still feel like there's something special happening on screen, and I think that that carries through the whole experience. So yeah, I'm a big fan of this. I think it's not my favorite film from the year it was released, because Rear Window also came out this year, but it is very, very good film.
How about for you, Noah? This was your first time seeing it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. I had not seen the film at all. I just knew, I knew that it was considered a classic, that it was considered one of Marlon Brando's great roles. And I knew that Roger Ebert had it on his initial list of great movies. And prior to our recording today, I went back and read his entry in that. And of course, I knew about the taxi scene with I Could Have Been a Contender, because that's one of those lines that has just been drilled with a diamond edged cutter into cinematic history and cinematic culture. But that's all I knew going into it. I'm glad I finally had the excuse to like make myself sit down and see it. There are definitely aspects of the film that are of their time. And you do have to kind of put yourself into a different mindset to approach the film kind of on its own terms. But I did find it really affecting. I would not say that it's a perfect film, even in terms of like coming at the film from its era. There are certain parts of the film that I think work better than others, but I imagine we'll get into that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, this was my like second time seeing it, and I had really when I reviewed it the first time, I was favorable on it, but definitely thought I was going to like it more than I did. And watching it this time was definitely an improvement, I feel like. I think I have a lot more appreciation for melodrama than I did the first time I saw this. It's funny, I looked at my old review, which didn't make me cringe as much as I thought it would. So that's saying something, I guess, considering I wrote it almost 10 years ago now.
you mean for your Best Pictures winner countdown, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, I gotta go back and read that now.
If you must.
I must.
Oh, but I described it as a big film and it wants you to know it, which is something I wouldn't disagree with now, but I think I intended that as a more derogatory line, and now I'm just kind of like, yeah, that's what the film is doing, that's what it's going for, and that's what it succeeds in doing, and why would that be a bad thing? It feels very operatic, and yet it also, like you were saying, Pat, it feels like it's tapping into something. The whole like religion aspect, which you brought up, Alex, I think is really played through in the sense that it's about what does being like, what does it really mean to follow the teachings of Jesus or any religion for that matter? What does it mean to like apply that to real life? You know, there's that great exchange between Carl Malden, one of the goons working for Johnny Friendly. And he says, "Stay in your church, Father." And Malden, as Father Barry, says, "Well, this is my church." And it's like this is the actual application of what Jesus was talking about in his view. And that's kind of carried through, too, of what it means to actually be religious and actually actually challenge the status quo, the way that Jesus did in his own time.
Yeah.
And there is this like lovely thing about like there is this great redemption arc in Terry Malloy. I like that he always seems like he's sort of like he's almost like fighting against his conscience. Like early on in this movie, there's a way in which his body betrays the way he's actually feeling that his words do not. And I love that you can see both those things in his performance.
But and you I know think conscience will drive you nuts.
And I love the look of the movie. I mean, the black and white is just really makes everything look that much more stark. I've never seen so many. I don't think there's ever been this many iron gates in any movie ever. And a lot of like really key moments take place there. It almost looks like they're locked in or like hemmed into this fortress or something. And it's just, it has so many things going for it. I think I might maybe respect it more than love it, like with like my whole heart, but that respect is well earned. And I'm really glad that I got to see it again, because I think it really did shake off a lot of the biases I might have had against movies of this genre when I saw it the first time. So that was like very refreshing.
I definitely felt watching it this time that I was certainly aware of where the movie is dating itself. And I was thinking in the category of every vice is a virtue and every virtue is a vice, that it's got a beautiful score by Leonard Bernstein, but talk about melodramatic.
Yeah.
the score is a lot.
Yeah.
To put it succinctly.
Even the volume at certain points, I was like, whoa, okay, that is really loud. And in case they wanted to emphasize that this is supposed to be a big moment, they are hitting us over the head with a hammer.
I think that's a good point, because a lot of modern, especially like that's a big criticism of Hans Zimmer these days, that, oh, he just goes for like the boom. Like, he's not the first one, guys. This is as long as there's been music in movies,
yeah,
there have been movies that are like, we're just going to go boom.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like, here's how you're supposed to feel, or here's how we want you to react to this moment. We're going to give you this very handy guide to let you know that this is a big, big moment. But it's a beautiful score. I'm a big music person, and the kind of romantic melody that runs through it is really famous, and you hear it a lot. And I was really enjoying hearing it again, but also thinking, wow, sometimes less is more. Like nowadays, you wouldn't necessarily be hitting people over the head that way with the music. And I also had something to say about the religious part of the movie, which I had not realized. Like I said, when I was watching this movie for the first time, I was a Catholic schoolgirl. But I had forgotten what a huge part of this movie that aspect is. And it made me go back and do a little research about Catholic priests who were involved with activism, and was reading a little bit about Father Berrigan during the Vietnam War era, which is something that I did remember. But it surprised me in this movie that it played such a central thematic role. And then I found out that this character, the Carl Malden character, was based on a real live human being, a priest from that era who they wrote a book about called The Waterfront Priest. And I guess, I think maybe I read that the priest sued them because they took his story and he felt used it to make this movie, which I think is kind of ironic and funny. But yeah, I thought that part of the movie was very central and very interesting. And I felt if this real life person hadn't existed, I can't imagine that part of the movie would have been so prominent and played such a big role in how the movie unfolds. But yeah, I enjoyed that whole discussion. Again, I feel like this is a place where movies can go beyond just entertaining and spark some real discussion about, you know, what your religion might mean in everyday life, if you're a religious person, and why we're all here. What even the line early in the movie where Eva Marie Saint is having the discussion with Marlon Brando, their first date where they go out, and she says something like, he says, you know, you have to be hard, you can't really care about everyone. And she says something like, but isn't everyone supposed to care? Aren't we all part of each other? Like, doesn't everyone care? Aren't we all supposed to care about each other because we're basically all one? And I thought, wow, how very new age of Bud Schoenberg way back when, because I felt like that was a sentiment that I would not be expecting to hear voiced in a movie from the 1950s. And that was really refreshing. And I think maybe a little ahead of its time in some ways, but apparently not really. So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that does play into the sort of Catholic background of this film as well, though, because there's this whole idea in the Catholic Church of that we are all part of the body of Christ, and that we need to work as this community together. And I think that is kind of like made manifest by this priest character, as you've spoken about. And that is really, when I watched it the first time within the context of a theology class that I was taking in college, that was a big part of the discussion around the film and the talk about, he's not specifically labeled as a Jesuit priest in the film, but the real life person he is based off of is a Jesuit priest. And Jesuits are amongst all of the sects of Catholicism, the group that is most known for being directly engaged in social justice throughout history. And I think that is really on display in this film in a really interesting way. But I think what's also really interesting about the film is that it presents the culture around the docks as its own form of religion, right? This idea that really the people in the film that are the most ideologically driven, the most dogmatic, are the people who are ensconced by the thrall of the mobsters who are in charge of the piers. They're the ones who will use any sort of rationalization to just comply with what is needed, right? The kind of idea of like a fundamentalist is kind of on display by them. And we see the flaws in the system like that, where people from the top really can leverage a lot of unnecessary power and it ultimately has this very corrupting influence. And I think that it's interesting to use that fundamentalism as a contrast to religion in a film like this, and the way in which that the actual religious figures are presented in more humanistic terms. It's a really interesting way to look at the film. And I think it's one of the reasons why the film works best for me as sort of a parable more than an actual story about real life people. Because of course the ending of the film is incredibly unrealistic to what would have happened to someone who did what Terry Malloy did. I was listening to an interview with Martin Scorsese, also featured in the Criterion's special edition, talking about his love of the film. And he says that one of the things that he loved most about the film is how it really felt like the people that he grew up around, he could identify these people. It was really one of the first films that he saw in theaters where it was real people that he could identify and know from his own life. But that being said, his least favorite part of the film is the ending, because it was the thing that he knew even as a child wouldn't have happened. He knew even as a child, someone who would have spoken out like that would have ended up, as he said, in the river face down. So it's really notable. But I think that if you look at it more as a parable for what you need to do to be a good person in the world, I think it works really well. And I think it's the sort of message that resonates even now more than ever, honestly. I think it's kind of a timeless message of being willing to sacrifice yourself for what is right and to face down against tremendous odds and tremendous corruption and tremendous immorality, right? And of course, there's a religious aspect of that, but you don't need to be religious for that story to really affect you on a personal level.
Yeah, and I think that's something about the film that rises above the very political nature behind its creation and the intent of the director.
It's fascinating to me, like, reading about this movie and seeing that it did kind of start based on a real event. It was based on articles by Malcolm Johnson, who had written about corruption at the Hoboken docks. And Arthur Miller was originally involved with the screenplay. It's fascinating to me because I believe A View from the Bridge was around this time, his play, which also takes place in the docks. But I think it was actually called The Hook. I believe that was the
original title
they were going for.
And, which is actually, I like the way The Hook is used. Probably because the hook is that are used by the Longshoremen is very symbolic in the movie in a lot of ways.
Yes. Yeah, and I will say just apropos of nothing, the film I had seen before this one was the original Candyman. So I was really thinking about hooks in a totally different way watching this, which was not an intention of the film.
I saw that yesterday. I saw the new Candyman yesterday, and was thinking the same thing. I was like, oh my gosh, hooks again. Yeah. Hooks all over the place.
It's hooks all the way down.
It also works because Marlon Brando's character was a boxer, and there's a lot of talk about like a right hook that he could have taken and all that kind of stuff too. So it really has that kind of multiple meaning. Man.
And the pigeons also are the other big motif with multiple meanings, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Pigeons and homing pigeons and. Yeah.
I just want to mention just that we've got it here in the recording. So the two main inspirations were the longshoreman Anthony DeVincenzo, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, was the whistleblowing longshoreman that Marlon Brando's character was, or that Terry Malloy was based off of. And the priest who was more or less the inspiration for Father Barry was Father John M. Corridon. Oh.
Yep.
The Lee J. Cobb character, the mob boss, amalgamate character?
Yeah.
Amalgamous character of a couple of different mob, mafia, crime family figures.
Yeah, I was thinking it's kind of a brave movie because it was made at a time when this was still going on and went on for quite a long time. Yeah. This movie was made, and I think it takes some guts to decide you're going to tackle this, especially given the powers that be on the other side of things. And you know, it didn't all end up rosily for the real person who was the whistleblower. One of the articles I read said, unlike Terry Malloy, his attempts to bring this corruption down failed. And you know that's true because in the 70s, people were still being hauled into courts, different mob bosses, and the activity, the longshoreman activity was part of that. So obviously it was an ongoing problem. It seems to me, in having read a little bit more about Ilya Kazan, that a lot of the projects that he took on were really driven by his views and his concerns about social justice, including the movie he did, I think, before this, his big movie was Gentleman's Agreement, which was about anti-Semitism, interestingly enough. So not to make a bad pun, but he was all over the waterfront.
That's a good way of putting it.
On the issue,
but it's also
he's covering.
What I found really interesting. So one of his most direct inspirations, especially at the time that he was actually producing the movie, because it had been, you know, he started working with Arthur Miller. He'd been bouncing around the idea for a while, but he was very motivated at the time that it was made by the fact that he had decided to testify to the House or the House Committee for Un-American Activities, which was part of the multi-pronged effort to root out, in air quotes, communists and un-American. I'm still doing the air quotes. You can't see it, listeners. But communist and un-American activities. I did not realize this until just now.
Really? Lee J. You've never Cobb, heard of this?
What?
You never heard
no, no,
of
no.
this?
I heard, no, I had heard of this. What I'm trying to say is I was unaware that Lee J. Cobb, who plays Johnny Friendly, also testified in front of the committee and was also, like Kazan, was also alienated from the Hollywood community for a period of time. So, yeah, I just popped open Lee Cobb's Wikipedia page to take a quick look at his filmography. And it said there as well that he also testified in front of the, so he also had a motivation, like at the same time making this film, of making a comeback. And like Kazan apparently explicitly said a few decades later, I wanted to stand up in that Academy Awards stage and just say, fuck you to all my critics. So there is a social aspect side to it, but there's also a personal aspect too, which I can respect.
But it is a contested point of history, how much of an influence that actually had on the creation of the film. It's something that Kazan has talked about a lot after making the film, saying that that was a core reason for his participation in it and like why it's written the way it is. But the screenwriter says outright that that is not true, and that that's like fabricated history that Kazan is playing off of, and that it was much more motivated by the real life events of the film, of what the film is based off of. And it actually, apparently, for a significant number of drafts of the film, there wasn't even a place where he testifies against these people, that that was not part of the film up until the last two drafts of it, which I thought was very interesting, because it feels like so much of the movie is built around that. So it's very curious that for so long it wasn't a part of what they were doing. But
Alex, we need a Mank-esque biopic of Bud Schulberg now.
Could we have a better movie that we base it off of?
Well, did you guys read in kind of looking into the background of this film that there was some pressure on Schulberg and Kazan to make the heavies in the movie communists?
Yeah.
I saw that, yeah.
I think is so bizarre. I was like, how are they going to make the bad guys on the docks the communists? I don't know, like maybe I have a skewed vision of what actually
idiocy finds a way. Sorry, I have to say that properly. Idiocy finds a way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading a little bit about Bud Schulberg, and I also, like, he was another one who had testified before HUAC. And he actually, it's fascinating to me because the way he talks about
testimony all the way down.
Yeah. Well, the way he talks about doing that is he was saying that he felt like a lot of his projects were being held up by people who were communists in the Hollywood community, and that there were a lot of people that he thought were not just communists, but like Stalinists that were overlooking all of the atrocities that were committed. And so that was like his sort of way of either, you know, of substantiating his reason for testifying. But to get back to like what influence this might have had on the movie, I think it's like hearing Kazan talk about it and talking about the moment when Terry says to Johnny Friendly, like, I'm glad I did what I did. Like that can, I think there can be a way in which you're making something that doesn't have to do with any aspect of your life, but in a very key moment becomes something that is. And I feel like that's kind of, I feel like that's maybe an accurate, like that's a representation of like what this movie is, where it didn't start out as something about that, but in some ways maybe became influenced by that, in, you know, directly or indirectly. So I don't think it's not a one-to-one correlation. I don't think it was an intentional allegory of the experience, but it feels like aspects of it did creep in.
Oh, definitely.
And certainly, or at least even like felt like they were representative of what Kazan had gone through. And I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah, sort of like when Tolkien insists that no, there's no allegories in Lord of the Rings. What are you talking about?
No, I was going to say the exact same thing, Justin. It's not an either or thing. I don't think it's this clear, you know, oh, I felt this way, so I was going to make this movie to kind of vent those feelings and frustrations and make a defense for myself. I feel like this was a movie that he was planning on making, and then real life events started to happen, and those in some ways crept into how he felt about this movie, and maybe how I hear that he was the ultimate actor's director, that he spent a lot of time with actors, actually co-acting through scenes with them and really talking things through. And I can imagine that what he was going through in his personal life would also have influenced him in those moments, and made their way into the film in that kind of subconscious way, so that it wasn't actually, you know, an intentional thing, but just sort of happened over the course of time. Things just came together that way. And I do think that it's a good thing, I think, and a happy thing that view of the film didn't really pull the film down or you know, kind of blacklist the film in some way as being a film that now we shouldn't admire or watch anymore because it's associated with this kind of unsavory period of time. And wasn't really something I knew much about until, like I said, I went and did some research for our talk this morning.
Yeah, and for people who don't know the controversy that we're talking about, basically to flesh out a little bit more what Noah was mentioning, is that Ilya Kazan was brought to QAC to testify, and he did something that many people found to be objectionable at the time, which was actually name names of fellow people who were associated with the Communist Party in Hollywood. And that's something that was considered a black mark on his legacy, all the way to the point where when he received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Oscars in the last 20 years or so, many people in the audience, many prominent people in the audience refused to applaud him. They sat in protest, and there were actually protests outside of the venue when it happened. And I think his legacy on that respect is complicated. I think people have their opinions on whether that was a good thing for him to have done, if it was the right thing for him to do. I think we all kind of have the opinion now that those committees and hearings were completely out of bounds. And I think that there's some people have a level of compassion for him for being placed in that position and for having to do something that no one would want to be in a position to do. Other people feel like you just don't rat on your friends, no matter how unjust the system is that you're getting caught up in. It's very interesting to have that as an aspect of like background for this film, because this film exists in such a different moral world than that situation, where the police are not necessarily everyone's friend, but justice is considered a clear path that Terry just has to take. And it would be a difficult path for him to take, but the path is right in front of him. He just has to choose to take it. And obviously a situation that Ilya Kazan was in is much more complicated. So it is, I think it's interesting the ways in which this movie kind of is an apology for what he had done or a defense for what he had done. And then the ways in which it so differs from the situation that he was in. And I think that that's just interesting to consider as well.
It's not necessary, though. I think you can watch this movie and not know any of that. It does hold up or fail if you decide you don't like it. I think it's definitely one of those movies that can be judged on its own merits. Cinephiles know all of this background, and it remains fascinating to talk about. But
Yeah, it's notable just because that is something that a lot of people watching it at the time would have also been aware of. But I do think that what Pat says is interesting, too, which is that despite all of that controversy swirling around it, it didn't sink the film. Instead, the film kind of ended up soaring to incredible incredible heights that ended up causing it to be considered one of the best American films ever made. And I think that that's a real, really remarkable. You wonder if a film released under that sort of context in this day and age would be able to sail through all of that and reach the status that On the Waterfront was able to reach on its own merits.
I think one of the interesting things is that Marlon Brando himself didn't originally want to do the film because he was upset with Kazan, but he made his peace with Kazan, and it seems like a lot of the big actors and people in movies at the time, to some extent, moved forward with Kazan because he made his case as something that he was doing out of good conscience, speaking of conscience, which is the big, big thing in the movie, and that it wasn't about him just trying to sell out friends so that he could keep working, that he really felt like regret about the time he had spent as a communist and really felt like communism was a big threat. Now, obviously, we're looking back at it through a completely different lens in a different time, and nobody is that sympathetic to that viewpoint, but at least he in the moment was making a claim that he was really doing this from his heart with good intentions and not just for monetary or career convenience so that he could keep working. And I guess a lot of the people who knew him well and were closest to him really felt that that was true. And they were able to get past it with him. At least that was what some of the things that I read suggested. But for me, I know now we're really diverting from talking about the movie, and to go back to the movie itself, something that I discovered was that even within the bounds of the movie itself, this movie has a kind of sacred place because it's credited with being one of the first movies where a whole new way of acting was being used on screen by Marlon Brando, and the whole discussion about method acting and how that really changed Hollywood and the course of where movies went after this is something that this movie is credited with, which I had no idea about before today. And in particular, the scene that's always thrown up is the scene in the back of the cab, and how Marlon Brando's very naturalistic acting, which is he sort of did ad lib in that scene. He was being told by Kazan to play that scene a little differently, and he changed it on the spot, and it's his acting in that scene that a lot of people think makes this the best performance by an actor in a movie ever. I read a lot about that. And contrasting that with kind of the old style acting, which is, one person said an example of that would have been Carl Malden as the priest giving that speech about the crucifixion, right? With all the longshoremen gathered around him, which
is, if you think Christ isn't here in the waterfront, you've got another thing coming.
But Marlon Brando's reading of those lines, and particularly, although the big famous line is, I could have been a contender, the line that really gets discussed is the way he delivers, "Oh, Charlie," when he's talking to his brother, which is a really beautiful moment. And, no matter how you feel about the film, watching those few lines between those, brothers in the script, I think they're very moving. And even if the film is not your thing, you gotta give them credit for an amazing piece of work right there. I can really understand why through the years there's been a lot of focus on that particular scene in the movie.
Yeah, that scene is one of the parts of the movie where I'm like, okay, no, I completely see why these performances in this movie has had such an enduring effect. I think part of what makes it so powerful for me is we have very little of the brother in the movie. We hear Terry talk about his brother, but like the handful of times we see them together, you know, his brother's doing his, you know, tough guy boss shtick. And the only thing we know going into that scene really about their relationship is what Terry's related to us. But we're given, we get so much in that scene, and it make, like, up until that point, we really don't have a reason to feel sympathetic for the brother. Charlie's his name, right? That's the older brother.
Yeah, played by Rob Steiger.
Well, one scene that he has with the mob boss where he does try to kind of defend his brother. And I think that is an important kind of foundation for the scene in the back of the cab, because you see that he's not just a flunky. He really is trying to stand up for his brother, but he's in this impossible situation where there's just no way to maintain his own status and potentially his own life and protect his brother at the same time.
Yeah. Well, and he knows, like, you can tell that he knows that he's a dead man as soon as he lets Terry out of the car. Terry doesn't know it. I actually don't think Terry does know it at that moment, the character Terry. But Charlie knows. Like, he knows. I'll make up an excuse, but you can see in his eyes, he's like, no, I'm dead. Which leads to one of the more affecting uses of the hook in the movie.
It's very, kind of terrifying, honestly. I read their relationship, I guess, maybe a little bit differently, because I saw the brother as being, like, certainly not being guiltless in any way, but also, like, kind of playing, like, referee between Terry and Johnny, like, in a way, like almost
him with a newspaper, literally.
Almost like protecting him in a way, recognizing that, you know, the man that he works for is incredibly dangerous and has no qualms about dealing his own brand of justice and or vengeance. And so I saw him as very conflicted. And I think that scene in the cab is really key. And it's really interesting that the whole, like, I could have been a contender is like the thing that people remember from that, because for me, it's about the two of them more than it is about just Terry. And I love the fact that you can see in that moment when he pulls the gun on his brother that he really doesn't want to do that, and he feels like he's been reduced to that, and how he recognizes he's fucked up. He's fucked up this whole thing. But it doesn't mean that he doesn't love his brother, and he's going to make the ultimate sacrifice. And so I guess I actually think he might, like, Rod Steiger as his brother is maybe my favorite supporting performance, like, maybe, well, I don't know, Ava Marie Saint's pretty great too, but I just think he has to negotiate so many different, like, conflicting forces in his life, and that to me made him a more sympathetic character and made the moment when Terry, you know, sees what's happened to him really hit and really be emotionally satisfying and really convincing in terms of why Terry would, like, didn't just care about him because he was his brother, but because of who his brother was and recognizing what he had to do for him.
I think the moment I feel like we know that Charlie is doomed is the moment, which I had forgotten about, when Terry says to him, when Charlie is still trying to justify that he did right by his brother and says something to him about how his boxing coach, you know, could have taken him further. And Terry turns to him and says, no, it was you, Charlie.
Yeah.
You told me it was because of what you were doing that I had to take a dive and throw that fight. And I think right in that moment, you're like, okay, so Charlie is, his soul can't be saved, because he's basically doomed his younger brother to the life that and put him in the predicament that he's now in. And movies like this, you always pay for your sins eventually, right? And so in that moment, I thought, yeah, I mean, I had seen the movie already, but in that moment, I think you kind of know where things are headed for Charlie, because he still, even then, hadn't come completely clean with Terry and apologized for having set his life on the course that it took, and it's Terry that has to hold him to account and say, no, you know, you can't still be wriggling out of this. I'm here because of the decisions that you made. And I thought, yeah, that's it for Charlie right there.
There's another scene that I'd like to highlight, or I'd like to know if you guys have a comment on it. Another moment in the movie that really hit me, that that functioned in a way that I wasn't expecting, was the scene where, at the priest's urging, Terry basically comes clean to, Edie Doyle, when he comes clean. And it's not in terms of the dialogue, it's not a complete scene. There's like the editing gets much quicker. I think there actually is no score. We're hearing the whistles of the ships,
but at
an ear-shattering intensity. And it's a much, I mean, not rapid-fire editing by today's standards, but by the film standards, it's a much quicker edit between the two of them and shots of the dock. And you're only getting, like, pieces of what Marlon Brando is saying. Well, but the focus is on the reactions.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that scene to play out that way, and I found it much more affecting than if we just had a straight-up, you know, a classic straight up, you know, sentence dialogue.
And I think it's key that, like, the way that it plays out, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you hear him make the confession saying that he was responsible for setting up her brother, but after that, everything beyond that gets drowned out. And it's almost like she can't hear past that initial revelation.
Yeah, that's so effective, I think. Because they're using the, of course, in the perfect use of the longshoreman thing, they're using the blaring of the ship horns. But I think it's a physical interpretation, or a real life auditory interpretation of what really happens to people psychologically, right?
You have Eddie's mental state at that moment.
Right, right.
Yeah. Edie, sorry.
Right, okay. She only hears the initial confession, and is just so blown away and devastated that all the excuses and his, you know, defense that he didn't know that they were going to push him off the roof. He never really thought it would go that far. She can't hear that. And then the movie takes the ship horns and actually has that be the stand-in for what's actually going on inside her head, which is that, you know, she really can't hear the defenses because she's just completely shocked to find out from him that he really was involved. And and I think it's great.
I think it's one of Ava Marie Saint's, like, highlight moments in the movie in terms of her performance.
It's also a nice little stall for the audience too, because if you were to have a full confession scene from him in that scene and then go into the courtroom a scene or two later and have him do it again, the courtroom scene would feel anticlimactic. But instead you get to have this moment where you get to have him confessing to her and you get the emotional impact of it, but you don't get the full confession until the court scene.
Right, because we've already heard that. And then to make us sit through hearing it all over again, I mean, we know what happened. So this is a way to shorthand it, right, so that the audience doesn't have to be walked through it again. But, I mean, we haven't really talked about her performance. And it is...
I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say. I just want to say up front, I felt a bit frustrated, not with her performance, but with her character. I think some of this has to do with, I think, kind of just the way a lot of women characters were still being written and handled at this time. she is a really interesting character and obviously has like a strength that she's always being teased for, oh, you belong with the sisters. You're just a school kid and you don't know the real world. But she proves through her actions that there is a toughness there. And like, and, you know, maybe she is a bit young and inexperienced, but there's still like there is a fierceness to her. And I found it frustrating that as the film progresses towards the end, she's kind of just reduced to screaming Terry in very loud tones of voice and doesn't get to do much else. And there are a couple moments where I'm like, I feel like the film is just not doing this person justice. And it's one of the parts of the movie that frustrated me a little bit. I wonder if you guys would agree or if you think I'm totally off base with that.
I agree with it. I think in the early parts of the movie, she is the strongest person in the movie. Maybe to a degree that I almost found a little incredible, given that her brother has just died and she really loved him, that she's not reduced to incapacity by sheer grief. Like at some points in the early parts of the movie, I thought, I hope a couple of weeks have gone by, because she doesn't look like she's been crying for hours and hours, which I feel like if your brother just got killed might be the more realistic thing. But she is incredibly tough, and she is the conscience of the movie in the early parts of the movie. Even, I mean, as we know, even beyond the priest character, she gives him,
right,
you know, his comeuppance, yeah, for hiding in his church and not coming out. And it's because of her that he realizes what, you know, what he should be doing and what his mission is. So I read that in the scene where they go out, when Terry and Edie go out for the first time, that they purposely put her in the upper corner of the screen in some of the shots so that she, because of her blonde hair, she kind of looks like an angel and his guardian angel and kind of the voice of conscience for him. So I think she has a really powerful role in the beginning. But as the movie progresses, I totally agree, she has less and less to do other than react. And I think a scene that really struck me as dating the movie was the scene where he comes and breaks in to her room.
Oh, yeah.
I had
a Mystery Science Theater moment where that happened. I was just like, oh, shoddy construction work strikes again.
Right. I was thinking, wow. Yeah, he got through that.
You can see the doorframe just bend inwards as he's kicking it in.
And then
it was like a tenement on the West Side, though. I don't think they had like, I don't think they were known for their craftsmanship in places like that.
I permitted myself a joke at the movie's expense at that moment.
But then, you know, his grabbing her and saying, you know, you love me, say you love me. I thought, yeah, this would, as you know, as a woman.
When he pulls her around the corner, I had a brief moment where I was like, oh, shit, are we going to go streetcar in this moment? And then it's like, okay, no, they're just kissing. And that, I was like, okay, like you avoided the worst.
The big homage to Streetcar is when he's down on the street yelling up to Joey in his window. And he's yelling, right, Joey. And I was like, oh, this is like the Stella moment. So parallel.
Guys, when did Streetcar come out? It was before this movie,
51,
right?
51.
Okay.
Streetcar was first.
Okay, right.
And so when I saw that moment, I was like, oh my God, that is so on the nose.
Theme culture did not start with the internet, my friend.
Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, in that moment, my 21st century feminist came out and I was like, yeah, this is not a good scene. this scene would be
hashtag problematic.
Yeah, it doesn't feel as romantic to a modern eyes.
Right. Yeah. I do think that, and she talks, you know, the actual actress, Eva Marie Saint, talks about the casting process. This was her first film, and she was thrown into a room with Brando and told, just play this scene out. This is your sister's boyfriend, and he's trying to get in. and you have to keep him out. And she said that that Marlon Brando immediately got her off balance. He teased her, he made her laugh. And within this improvised scene, she went from laughing to crying. And she said she was off balance with him for the rest of the movie. And I was wondering what that exactly meant. In real life, she was a newlywed, but there was clearly, she does talk about the fact that there was palpable chemistry between them. And so I feel like in the movie, the way that translated was that as the chemistry between her character in the movie and Marlon Brando builds, the movie focuses more on just, you know, how she's this young woman and he's her first real experience with being so powerfully attracted and romantically involved with someone. And then it's sort of their relationship sort of becomes about that. And her other function in the movie, which is, as I said before, to kind of serve as the conscience and sort of the touchstone for the morality of the movie, sort of fades into the background.
It gets subsumed a bit.
Yeah, as their romance becomes kind of more front and center. And I thought that was a shame. And maybe something that wouldn't happen if the movie was written now in this time period. Or maybe it would. I don't know.
That's one of the big things I was talking about when I said you can tell when the movie was. It's not a timeless movie in the sense that there are other movies that I would say, this could have been made any time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Well, I agree with that.
I think that the biggest criticism here is just that they actually developed a character that is strong enough to be a co-lead of the film, and then they just decided to not use her in that capacity. So she starts out feeling very much like she could help, like she could co-carry this movie with Marlon Brando. And then over the course of the film, you just start to realize that, well, actually, she's there to serve the same function that the priest is, that his brother is. And so now you have three characters filling the same role for Terry. And so then they all get marginalized slightly and only are impactful in the moments that they're impacting Terry. And they're no longer carrying their own stories. And I think that maybe if you made this movie today, she would have actually been a co-lead of the film and gotten to retain the agency and the tenacity that she has at the start of the film all the way through and actually have something meaningful to do beyond just inspire Terry to do the right thing, as these other events are also inspiring him to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think the same thing goes for the priest as well. You know, he says, I'm with you down to the wire. I'm with you all the way. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to move this and move that. We really only see him when he's talking to Terry, you know, so that I think that's another aspect where. And I think that was probably a reason why the real life priest was kind of in conflict with the filmmakers afterwards by saying, well, you took like part of my life story, but you left out like a lot of the other work that I did. And that was important, you know.
The movie has to have a focus, and I'm sure
that's
you
can true. Get yeah.
that yeah. saying this movie is really, in the simplest terms, about the battle for Terry's soul, right?
Sure.
Is he going to stay alive with all of his friends, the whole culture of growing up, his brother, everything that he's always known, or is he going to shift sides and wind up with people that hasn't had anything in common with and had never had anything to do with, a priest, a young woman from a Catholic college, and this is a big, big jump for him. And who's going to win in the end? Is he going to kind of stick with the safe way and not rock the boat and just move forward? Or is he going to put his life on the line and take a stand? And yeah, I mean, Eva Marie Saint, Carl Malden, they're all just the people who are, you know, the cheerleaders in the background, helping him make his decision. But he's clearly the focus of the movie, and I guess, you know, you can defend that choice by saying that makes the narrative pretty clear, you know, what we're talking about and who's at the center here. So.
And yeah, in terms of the trajectory, I guess I understand why she does fade into the background toward the end of the film, because he needs to be in that space where he is alone making the decision to at first testify and then later to inspire the other dock workers that this was the right thing to do and that they do have this power. So I understand, but I do think it is interesting that in that last scene when he is basically like almost on death's door, right. And he has to like get up and go into the factory, you know, take this sort of symbolic, you know, walk up Calvary, that the priest and Edie do help him up at least. So it's not like he can do it solely alone. He does That's need true. To have that help sometimes. And I think it also makes sense given that, because one of the things that really struck me watching it this time, even more so than the first time, was just how personal this quest is for him. It's not just about this abstract idea of, you know, of just doing the right thing. It's about the literal lives that have been lost, including people that were very close to him. And I think that's really evident in that last scene, especially.
Justin, I think that even going deeper than that, it's about his own pride and his own self-respect in the end. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to let this guy win. My whole life has been predetermined because of this guy and these people. And I mean, in that moment, I didn't really feel like it was all at all really about him making a decision. Oh, this is what's better for everybody.
Right.
Like it was this. The thing that gets him up is the priest whispering to him, Johnny is betting that you're not going to be able to get up and walk. And I thought, yeah, in the end, everything's personal. Right.
Yeah.
The political's personal. Everything's personal. It's all about. What is deep inside you. And I felt like that was that moment. I also felt in that moment that in a more realistic world that Edie would have been saying, are you freaking kidding me? He needs to go to a hospital.
Yes.
Like, I just thought, yeah, there's a lot of things that are not very realistic about that ending. But
Alex, with what insurance?
Exactly.
I have to say, a nitpicky part of me at that moment was like, why didn't Johnny Friendly just straight up kill him? Like, he Friendly admits, like, oh, the game's pretty much up at this point. Yeah, there are a couple months where I'm like, okay, he killed his brother. He had a car waiting, so they knew where he was going to be. Why didn't he have, like, a follow-up guy with a gun? Or, like, he knew he was in the restaurant at the night before. Like, why does he just wait for him to come to the courtroom and hope that he doesn't talk? I had a couple months where I'm like, Johnny Friendly's not that effective as a mob boss, is he? It's not Sopranos enough. More of a tenor. Oh.
Yeah, I really felt like that courtroom scene where Terry is about to testify and Johnny, in front of everybody, says, you know, you're never going to work again. And I mean, really, like, for the whole courtroom, just giving massive evidence of his own guilt.
You may have been right, but.
But then I thought maybe that scene was in there to explain why Terry is not immediately killed after testifying. I mean, I think up until that point, maybe Johnny is thinking he's not really going to go through with it. And then after Johnny confronts him in front of all these witnesses, saying basically you're dead, that then he can't have Marlon Brando's character, or he can't have Terry killed, because then everybody knows that it's him, and he's already in trouble. But
And there is a scene after the trial where Johnny Friendly is seen with all of his associates. Telling them, like, okay, you guys got to get rid of those guns. You got to get rid of this. There's this law that's going to come down now that I'm being found guilty for this thing, there's going to be all these other things, I'm going to go to jail if you guys keep doing stuff. So there is this kind of climate of, like, now that Terry has testified, there is increased scrutiny on everything that Johnny Friendly does, and so he can't kill him in retribution in the way that maybe he would want to. Now, whether it's realistic that he would have ever let him walk into the courtroom is a different question, you know.
It's like they had a cab driver set up. They had a cab driver set up to spirit away Charlie after letting Terry go.
But like the reason why he doesn't kill him is because then we don't have the movie that we have, right? Like it's an aspirational film, so you don't have the key witness who we've been following get killed before the end of the movie, right? Like that's the answer to your question. And it's kind of like, that's why I really think of this movie along the lines of a movie like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right? It's this kind of parable about American ethics and moralism.
Yeah.
And with this aspirational idea attached to it, right? This idea of like, well, if you actually are a good, earnest person, or you just make the choice to be a good, earnest person, then anything is possible in America, right? I feel like that's really the sort of mythos that this is playing with, and the way in which this movie works is on that level of parable, instead of like, well, would this realistically happen and how would it realistically go, right?
Yeah.
But I wanted to just move back slightly to talk about Marlon Brando's performance a little bit more before we close out, because there was another scene. Obviously, the scene that you guys spoke about so eloquently is the iconic scene of the film in the back of the cab. But there is another scene that I've seen kind of been broken down in interesting ways in the past that I think is worth bringing up as well, which is this scene between Eva Marie Saint and Marlon Brando as they're walking through the park across from the church. And it's this moment of improvisation that Marlon Brando does that I think speaks to this idea of him birthing this new form of acting. Because in that scene, Eva Marie Saint's glove actually falls on accident. It was not like a scripted part of the scene. It just fell. And instead of just letting restart the scene, Marlon Brando just picks up the glove right away and continues to play the scene. And he uses that glove. He plays with it. He toys with it. She kind of reaches for it at one point, and then he doesn't give it to her. Instead, he puts it on his own hand. And as they keep walking, and she eventually has to pull it off of his hand just so she can leave. And it adds all of this interesting kind of tension to the scene, and it clearly affects Eva Marie Saint's performance in the sense of, like, she is uncomfortable because she knows this isn't supposed to be happening. I'm supposed to have that glove, and now I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And so
maybe that's what she meant by always off balance. Like, he kept putting on my clothes. He had my dress on. It was weird,
In the context of the scene, it keeps pulling her closer to him, but with a lot of kind of tension and a lot of kind of resistance and hesitancy on her part. And it adds so much emotional context to that scene, which is really like a courting scene, right? Where it's like, is she going to kind of commit to him and to really follow through with this journey that she's on, or is this man too dangerous or not trustworthy enough? And so there's all of this stuff underneath it. He's kind of courting her in that moment. And it's just such an interesting choice to use that as a way to bring out all of this subtextual emotion in her, and also establish this interesting power dynamic with him as well. And it's all from picking up a glove that happened to fall on the floor. So I think that's a really cool moment.
I think that can happen, speaking from my limited acting experience, it's, this will happen sometimes where like something will go wrong and you have to react in the moment. And if you've done the work enough and you're in tune with your character, you'll think of this moment, not really think about it, just kind of instinctively react as your character would. And so improvisation doesn't have to be a way of like, just like veering off course. It can be a way of assessing this new situation in the way your character would and understanding how it ties into these larger ideas. Again, you don't want to think about it too much, but like that's the kind of the general idea. And I think that's what Brando was playing into in that scene.
And I will say, as the only female on this call, that I think he was aware at that point in his life of his attraction and his, you know, his magnetism with women. And I think he, from what I've read, was using it with her. And I feel like that's part of what she was talking about when she was talking about being off balance. I don't know if you guys have watched the documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon.
I have.
And there is a scene, and Justin, maybe you'll remember this, where they show him being interviewed by a young female reporter sent to just meet him for the first time and do kind of a tabloid type interview, I think. And it is so, I laughed out loud watching this scene, which is, it's, you know, it's a documentary, so it's a real life incident. And it was so clear to me that he was seducing her during this. And her response to him and the way that it kind of changed the trajectory of the interview, I just thought, wow, okay, there was the guy who clearly had a lot of animal magnetism. And and again, I mean, I was watching, I told you, I watched this with my older daughter. I watched the On the Waterfront with my older daughter. And at that point, she was in her late teens. And, she, you know, she turned to me during the movie and said, oh, my God, he was so hot. thought, yeah, there's no, there's probably no completely getting around that. And I think she said in one of her interviews that one of the things he was doing right from the beginning was teasing her, and I'm sure in a very flirtatious way. And I think that was probably getting a real response from her, like a genuine response, like Justin said, something that's not written in, but that is just happening naturally, and you're using it, and you're working off it. So yeah, I thought that scene outside the church when they're in the park there, I thought that was a great scene, and felt like I felt like there were many scenes in the movie as they're establishing their relationship where you really can see some sparks actually happening there. And you know, why not use that? I'm sure that directors are very happy when they don't have to manufacture that and they just have that in front of them to work off of.
Any final thoughts?
Well, I'll just say that I think it's an excellent film. And like I said, I think that it deserves its place in the canon of American films. I think it might not be my favorite film or the best film that I've seen even from this year, but that doesn't take anything away from how foundational it feels as a sort of American myth of the mid-century. And I think that it's something that everyone should watch. I think that anybody who watches it will get a lot out of it. And I also, the music is so incredible. I know that it can sometimes feel a little bit overbearing, but it's also so beautiful that it just, and it, I really do feel like it helps amplify that idea. This is this mythic quest that he's on, and this is a parable about saving a man's soul and about standing up for what is right in the face of all that is wrong. And I think that the music knows that, and it really amplifies what's already going on in the acting and the direction. So I'm a big fan of this, and I'm really happy for the opportunity to revisit it. And I really, again, want to recommend anybody who has access to either the Criterion channel or wants to buy the Criterion Blu-ray special edition of this to do so, because it has great, great special features. There's a commentary track. There's hours of supplemental material. And it's really, if you're a big fan of this, it's really worth your time.
Yeah, and I think my final thoughts are just it won a lot of awards. I didn't realize it had won 8 Academy Awards, and some of the categories that we referenced but didn't specifically talk a lot about were cinematography, set design and production, and all of those things where I thought were really well done and beautiful. And I thought the writing, I mean, we haven't specifically talked about the writing, but I really enjoyed a lot of the writing. I felt like they really captured, he must have done a lot of research to really capture the vernacular, right? The way that that someone like Terry would actually talk, and all of the idioms that the longshoremen use. And that probably took a lot of thinking and doing, and I think in most of it came across very naturally. And there were moments, there were even some little moments of humor in some of the exchanges that I really appreciated. Hats off to Bud Schulberg. I think he did a really good job, actually.
Yeah, one of the phrases that Father Barry uses anytime he's talking to Terry about like seeking this, you know, violent course of revenge is firing lead. And he says it like multiple times. And every time he said, I'm just like, that's such a very specific way of referring to that particular act. And I just love that that's the way he refers to it. And I think that's, you know, to your point about like capturing the vernacular.
Didn't you laugh like when he's describing Eva Marie Saint? He's like, you had those ropes of hair and she's like blades. And he said, you had to on your teeth and glasses. And then he says to her, you were a mess. And I thought there were those you needed a couple of moments like that because it's a pretty, it's a pretty heavy movie. And there were just like these little glimpses of this humanity and humor that he had that I really, really loved and just really did make me laugh. So I appreciated that as well.
Yeah. I'll just say for my final thoughts, like I'm really glad to revisit this. So thank you, Pat, for that, because I feel like I have a better, much, much more informed appreciation of this movie now than when I first saw it. I love how big it is. I love how operatic it is at points. I also would just say that like I was really struck by the locations in this movie. Like they seem almost otherworldly at points. Like that park outside the church doesn't seem like it's not portrayed in the way you typically would see it in the movies. It's like there's a lot of like fog moving through it. It feels like they're like wandering the wastes or something. And then just like rooftops or the docks themselves, like they just feel like very specific places that don't get shown in movies a lot. And that's definitely saying something. And I think the black and white photography really, really amplifies that. So, yeah, definitely really glad I saw this again.
Well, thanks for having me. I learned a lot from preparing to participate, so that was fun.
Yeah,
it was a pleasure having you on.
Yeah.
You're welcome back anytime.
Yes, indeed. If ever not already evident.
I'll pick you up on that.
So just before we end, Noah, did you want to share your final thoughts?
Not much more than what I've already said. It's the best parts of this movie absolutely have withstand the test of time, and it's easy now. It's nice to go back and see something that you've always heard of as being the super influential thing, and to get an appreciation for where that influence came from. And sometimes that reputation ends up being justified, sometimes it's not. But in the case of this movie, I think it very much is. So as we discussed, some of the more questionable aspects aside, really are secondary to the film's main strengths. Most of which center around the cast, I feel.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about where we can find everybody these days. And I'll start here and just say you can find me at thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. You can also find me on another podcast, which I mentioned earlier, Pod on the Rooftops. This is a podcast dedicated to the rock band Genesis that I did with Noah and his brother Luke Martin. It's on thepopbreak.com. That would be the best place to find that. And I'll go to you next, Noah.
All right. Well, in addition to my work here, as Justin said, you should definitely check out our podcast on Genesis, Pod on the Rooftops. And you should also check out my written materials on my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Awesome. And Pat, did you have anything you wanted to plug or anywhere we can find you on the interwebs?
I don't have a public persona. No social media profile. You'll just as a guest on your
You only party. Have one incarnation. Gotcha.
That's okay. Right. That's it.
It's a physical.
You got me. That's it.
Okay. Let's and we'll go to you next, Alex.
You can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can also follow our show on Twitter at Cinema Joes, where you can see updates on our newest episodes. They come out every other Thursday. In addition to that, you can check out my work over on thepopbreak.com as the podcast's editor. Best place to see all the shows that I'm on and working on is to just go to thepopbreak.com and click on podcasts. You'll see all of the newest episodes of our TV, film, music, and different other podcasts that we're working on the regular basis. So if you want to subscribe to those podcasts, you could subscribe to them on all of the major podcast platforms by subscribing to The Breakcast or Pop Break TV or Socially Distanced or a couple of other ones that you can check out. But the easiest place is to just go straight onto the website and sample and see what you're liking. So definitely do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you for sticking with us, as I want to say. And we will be back talking about probably many more favorite movies as well as newer releases. So we look forward to doing all of that for you.
Spoiler, there's sand and it gets everywhere and I don't like it.